on the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 5, police are trying to determine how and when a newborn baby died in Bolton. The baby's body was discovered near a country lane yesterday. Officers are concerned for the welfare of the child's mother and are appealing for her to come forward. Chief Inspector Carol Martin from Greater Manchester Police says the baby was found wrapped up in clothing and plastic bags.
There was also a note which requested that the baby receive an Islamic burial. Obviously this incident's very upsetting. At the moment we're investigating how the baby and when the baby died, and also in trying to locate the parents of the baby.
One of the two men jailed for life for the murder of black teenager Stephen Lawrence has dropped his appeal against his conviction. Gary Dobson was put behind bars last year for killing the teenager in London in 1993. The Rail Minister has called the ruling by the High Court into government consultations on the planned HS2 stations on the landmark H3. The government won the landmark H3 temples being challenged, which the government says gives the scheme the green light. Independent MP Eric Joyce has been banned from buying alcohol from the parliamentary estate. The former soldier was arrested last night following a brawl at a bar in the House of Commons. The schools minister says he's confident the coalition government can meet the challenge when it comes to increasing school places in England. More than a quarter of a million extra places could be needed by next year. And Pope Francis has paid tribute to his predecessor, Benedict XVI, saying his faith and teaching has enriched the Catholic Church. That's the latest. I'm Danny Crawshaw.
BCFM.
On BCFM.
Doing it for the love of house music. Love of house music.
Yes, after our 2 week break, we're back. It's Friday, 5 o'clock. BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. Tony Gosling helping us review this week's news is Lib Dem councillor for Cabot Ward in the city centre, Mark Wright. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, the voice of a true US Army hero, a leaked audio recording of Bradley Manning giving his secret testimony to a secret court about why he leaked to WikiLeaks. Also, the Police Federation ballot their members and get an 80% majority in favour of questioning the right to strike. But nothing will change. Why is that? Chairman of Avon and Somerset Police Federation, Kevin Phillips, is here to explain that, amongst other questions. EDF Energy, who are planning to build a new nuclear power station at Hinkley, dropped their £5 million legal action against protesters. We hear from Friends of the Earth's Mike Birkin. Plus, delayed from 2 weeks ago, I thought the Japanese and Germans were supposed to be allies in World War II, so why does it look like it was Hitler's bomb that was dropped on Japan? Plus, Martin Summers takes his weekly tour of the world's hotspots. Well, actually, it's a fortnightly tour this time. That's all in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's 2 week weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Lows of 3 degrees Celsius and some heavy showers tonight, and this weekend though highs of 9 Celsius and also a fairly wet weekend. Next week highs of 11 Celsius, some sunshine at the beginning of the week but plenty of showers towards the end of the week. Next weekend, 23rd and 24th of March, highs of 7 Celsius, sunshine and showers still. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news, and last week's too, to a certain extent, is Lib Dem councillor for Cabot Ward in the city centre, Mark Wright. Hi, Mark. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, Tony. Thanks for having me.
First of all, because we're encompassing a couple of weeks this week, Chris Hume and Vicky Price going to jail. What are your thoughts about this? I mean, it's just another, it seems, reason for people not to vote, isn't it, when this kind of criminality is going on and MPs are going to prison?
I think it's a little bit more complex than that. I mean, I think the general public realises that the crime that they've gone to jail for, the crime of swapping points in order to avoid Chris Hume losing his licence because he already had 9 points, it's something that a lot of the members, a lot of the public have done, actually. I mean, the AA and some other motoring organisation did an investigation and said perhaps a million people have done this. Now, it is a crime, there's no doubt about that. And I think probably the public don't realise that it's a very serious crime, actually, because it's perverting the course of justice. It's about evading the law. I think it's probably the case that a jail term was appropriate because perverting the course of justice is rightly considered a serious crime. I think myself that 8 months is probably a bit harsh, actually. I think probably a couple of months with effectively out in, you know, the way it works in jail these days is you get out in half the time if you behave well. So a couple of months would equate it to, you know, out in 1 month. I think that's probably would have been a bit more reasonable, but I think that the judge wanted to, you know, make an example of them, which I can understand, but I still think that that's harsh.
But come on, Mark, I mean, this is an MP. Surely you should be saying, I better pitch myself. I mustn't break the law here.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, of course, he wasn't an MP when he did it. This was 10 years ago. And again, you know, I think it's a toughie because it's the kind of thing which a lot of the public don't think is particularly important. There are a number of laws which, you know, the public in general don't think are particularly important, you know, things to do with copyright and parking tickets and other things like that. These are actually crimes. I mean, what the mistake that they both made is that the lie that was a fairly small lie when it started then spiraled out of control. And, you know, the thing about little lies is that eventually you need big lies to hide them.
Well, look, to be fair, I mean, copyright's a civil offence. It's not a criminal offence. And I mean, you know, surely voters would respect you more if you just said bang to rights, I'm glad that the law has taken its course.
I think he would, I mean, he still would have had to go to jail probably if he had said bang to rights. You know, I mean, if when this first came up, I don't think there was any way for him to be evading jail. So, I mean, what the reason they fought it, of course, is because they didn't want to go to jail. They wanted to be found not guilty. But, I mean, although I think the public probably wouldn't have, you know, been so angry with them if they had said, if they'd come forward and said, you know, fair cop, I did it, I'm very sorry, they still would have gone to jail, actually. Perhaps for less time, but they still would have gone to jail.
Okay, what about, I mean, do you think that this is the tip of the iceberg? Are there other sorts of crimes going on amongst parliamentarians I mean, because surely the police have got a fair amount of discretion as to who they send to jail and who doesn't. It just so happens Chris Hughes was somebody who was energy secretary. He was actually very anti-nuclear, for example. Are you a conspiracy theorist at all? Do you think he was singled out in some way and that maybe there are other crimes which have been let go while this one was focused on?
I don't think that the police would have had any influence in that. I mean, the police, I think, you know, they'll put a case together and send it to the CPS. The CPS will decide.
What about Theresa May?
I think there's no doubt that the media went after him, and the media, in particular, the right-wing media, went after him and demanded blood because they absolutely didn't like him. He was the hardest hitting Lib Dem. I mean, he wasn't the leader, but there's no doubt he's the hardest hitting Lib Dem with the biggest teeth on the Lib Dem front bench. And the Tories did not like him because he was perfectly willing to go toe to toe with them, you know, against the Tory big beasts. And they're very, very pleased that he's out of the way.
Well, and he's had his teeth pulled to a certain extent, hasn't he? If I can use that analogy.
Yeah.
Next point really is about the Schools Minister David Laws. Now, he's a Somerset MP. He's committed £40,000 of fraud as part of the MP's expenses scandal. He's now Schools Minister. I mean, this just doesn't send the right message out to the voters, does it?
You're right. I mean, it certainly doesn't sound good. In David Laws' case, I'd point out, though, that he could have claimed that money within the rules, and the only reason he didn't claim it within the rules was because he would have had to declare that he was living with his lover, and he wasn't out, you know, out of the in terms of being publicly gay at that time. He could have legally claimed that if only he had declared his relationship with his landlord.
But I mean so the people listening will be thinking, how many other things are these MPs lying about? I mean, it's only maybe a small lie, but I mean, this is £40,000 of fraud committed here, and this is the guy in charge of our schools. It doesn't send the right message out to the voters or to the teachers or children in our schools, does it?
No, indeed. I mean, and that's absolutely right. Although, you know, and it's worth bearing in mind that nobody's got nothing to hide. I think everybody's got little lies in their life that they would rather not be exposed and that they keep for various reasons. The problem with the modern world, when you make it up to the top and being an MP, you know, the public expects such squeaky cleanness from their MPs that there are more and more things that you have to sweep away into your closet. And what that means, of course, is that the media now goes after those closets with ever increasing vigour.
I mean, how do we compare this, for example, with the chap that stole a bottle of water and got 4 months in prison during the riots?
That's a fair point.
How many bottles of water do you buy for £40,000 fraud? You know, it just doesn't seem to make sense to me.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very fair point. I mean, you know, that guy, of course, went to jail because the judges were attempting to set an example during the riots. I would say this, wouldn't I, because I'm a British politician, but I think we need to be a bit careful about getting too harsh on our politicians, because actually, if you compare our politicians with global you know, the global behaviour of politicians, where you've got, you know, for example, Silvio Berlusconi in Italy, he just got a 1 year in jail, and the only reason he's not currently in jail is because in Italy they don't send you to jail if you're over 75 and the jail term's under 2 years. He's 76 and he got a 1 year jail term. He's still the leader of his party, he's still negotiating to be in government, and he's still on trial for two other things, including paying an underage prostitute for sex and perverting the course of justice. So, I mean, this guy has been PM of Italy twice, and it doesn't even seem to be a major block on him. I think in general, politicians in Britain are substantially less corrupt than in almost all other countries.
And what about then the bankers in Britain?
The bankers, well, we have, you know, the most bankers per capita.
You have to be careful what you say.
Yeah, I know.
The bankers might be listening.
We have a lot of bankers. You know, London is basically the world's financial HQ. We have more bankers probably than anywhere else. We have the biggest bankers. No slip of the tongue there necessary.
They keep telling us they're going to leave, though, don't they?
They do, because they, you know, and I don't think they will leave.
No, they still haven't left.
Yeah, they still haven't left. They like it here because, for all sorts of reasons to do with, you know, the fact that they get a pretty good deal here.
I suppose they might go to Guernsey, maybe. That's not too far away. They could probably get back to London for their parties when they wanted to fairly easily.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's been a huge amount of lying and wheeling and dealing going on in the banking industry, which is only some of which is starting to be exposed. You know, I mean, the whole LIBOR scandal, I think, came out of the blue. Nobody, even some of my banker friends, were surprised to see that one come out of the woodwork. You know, that was something that was going on at the top, and I think a lot of the bankers at the bottom didn't even understand or see that coming. There may even be more stuff.
But with LIBOR, we've got prima facie evidence of fraud there over a long period of time. Massive numbers of, well, billions of pounds actually stolen from people's accounts because of that fraud.
Yes.
Right across the world. I mean, the Americans are starting to get their teeth into some of this.
Yes.
And fining. We seem to be into, I don't know quite why, settling out of court. You know, they don't even go to court. So you're looking at the individual traders that should be arrested, and also the directors of these banks that were responsible for them being arrested, but we don't see anything. So, I mean, I just, in a way, in a sort of defence of Chris Huhne and arrested MPs, I would say, I think, we really need to see the bankers arrested before we start moaning about people like Chris Huhne for his parking ticket. Just a bit of a left field question, Mark. Our football clubs in Bristol seem to be bankrupt and only kind of managing to survive by doing these desperate property deals where they're buying up cheap land, putting a stadium on there and selling off the old land to a supermarket.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, and there's been a lot of controversy about both sets of those plans because neither of those supermarkets is particularly welcome. And both of those sets of plans had previous sets of plans for new stadiums, which didn't involve supermarkets and which most people thought were pretty good and were quite happy to support. I think it's very regrettable. I mean, it's probably an indication of some of this sort of inner malaise in football these days, which is basically, unless you're in the top half of the first division, you know, you've got to scrimp and save and you're basically bankrupt. The moment you get in the top half of the first division, suddenly hundreds of millions of pounds seem to be falling out of the sky on top of you. And then you get to pay, you know, all of your footballers £10 million each a year. I don't like the way that this is all heading, actually. I'll be perfectly honest. I don't see anyone in the industry making serious steps to change it, though, unfortunately. I mean, there's big money in football now. You know, it's international oil sheikhs for people in the Premier Division. It's you know, national bankers for people in the second division. It's big finance people. It seems to be the done thing these days. You know, make a few hundred million and then buy yourself a football team to act as a kind of champion and have 40,000 people cheering you wherever you go.
Yeah, it seems a bit bizarre, doesn't it? Okay, you as a Lib Dem, you've just had your spring conference. We were just chatting before you came on air,
yeah.
And you said that you didn't go. But, I mean, if you're looking at a democracy, I mean, you would think that a political party would have to be democratic. As we know, there are all sorts of, you know, the Liberal Democrats from all over the country traipse down there. They put their hand up, they're voting on various things. It seems the less contentious stuff goes through and it becomes policy. Mm. The really contentious stuff, like this thing that's coming along at the moment with secret courts. Now, The Daily Mail's been running a campaign on it. Many of the national newspapers have been flagging this up as an incredibly dangerous move, which was instigated by Ken Clark, who, you know, fair enough, you know, he's not a Liberal Democrat. But I mean, these secret courts are going to allow particularly the security services, MI5, MI6, these very unaccountable already organisations, to run courts in secret, with evidence held in secret. We'll be hearing later on from Bradley Manning in the United States, who's been kept in a... is going through a military tribunal over there, which is all being done in secret. Now, a bit of audio has been leaked from that, incredibly. But, I mean, this is really not healthy for justice, because it looks like there may be criminals within those parts of the intelligence services, quite possibly over the years, who have got away with stuff. They're now worried, and that's why they're doing these secret courts. So why is it that at the Lib Dem conference, when there's a vote on the secret courts, the conference says, no, we're not going to have this legislation, but your leader ignores it?
Yeah, this is a very serious issue for Lib Dems, actually, because unlike the Labour and Conservative parties, the Lib Dem conference is still the sovereign body of the party, and it sets what the party policy is. It votes and ratifies the manifesto. And this secret courts legislation is the first time that the leadership of the party has ever instructed its instructed the MPs to vote against the will of resolved conference motions, and a lot of Lib Dems are very unhappy about that. Nick Clegg, a couple of weeks ago, of course, we won the Eastleigh by-election, and you know, most people would have thought the conference would have been almost ecstatic as a result of this, but actually it wasn't, because The conference took the by-election in their stride, but they were more than upset by the fact that Nick Clegg had pushed MPs and had made them vote in favour of this legislation. It is a problem. I mean, in respect to the legislation itself, the only point that I would make is that the arguments that have been put forward is that it relates not to criminal cases. The secret courts will be only used in civil cases, and almost invariably the government itself is the defendant in these cases. And this is potentially quite a difficult thing for the public to understand at first, but what's going on basically is that people who have been mistreated by the government in one form or another are taking the government to court, and the government is saying we've got a defence, but it relies on secret evidence, and we can't use that evidence in an open court. Until now, what the government has generally done is that they've had to just settle out of court. They've just had to say, we could defend ourselves, but because we can't use the evidence, we're going to have to just give you some money and settle out of court. It's not quite the same as the sort of Bradley Manning thing, where he is a criminal defendant. He is defending himself in a secret court, which I think almost anyone would accept is an absolutely disgraceful scenario, truly disgraceful. And I think I don't think that the British government is so daft as to propose anything like that yet. I mean, if they ever do, I hope that there would be absolute uproar in Parliament. I mean, but we shall see.
But I mean, ultimately, it's not democracy, is it? If your conference is voting one way and your leader is saying, no, we're going to ignore conference.
No, it's not. And there will be consequences, actually. And exactly what those consequences are, I'm not quite sure yet. But, you know, it's the party membership is not going to allow this to simply be washed along by the wayside, because, you know, this is the constitution of the party itself dictates that party conference is the sovereign policy-making body. So there is going to have to be some comeback on this. I'm not sure what it will be yet.
Okay, well, we'll wait and see if there is. That was Lib Dem Councillor for Cabot Ward, Mark Wright. Now, Martin Summers, old Labour Oxford economist, is here too. Martin, we've got budget week next week. Gorgeous George Osborne is going to be bringing his proposals to manage all of our money that we pay in taxes. What are your thoughts? And, you know, I mean, at the moment, it doesn't seem like he's going to be for turning, does it?
He's going to be for turning. No. I mean, they've locked themselves in, really. I mean, I think it's quite amusing in a way that they've lost the credit rating, the AAA credit rating, absolutely predictable. People said several years ago, in fact, I said to Nick Clegg just after he'd been elected, you're going to lose your credit rating if you follow this policy. And he just flim-flammed, but it was obviously going to happen. I think, really, intellectually, the government is defeated. The policy they've pursued has just not worked. But unfortunately, they don't seem to be able to change course, although I see Vince Cable is starting to make some noises, which I think are, you know, signs of the times. We'll see what will happen. But you can see that Liam Fox at the other extreme is doing a war dance for even more austerity.
Austerity, cutting taxes, and also cutting benefits. That's what he wants. And let's have a look, have a listen now to the North Somerset MP Liam Fox, former Defence Secretary. He was disgraced and forced to resign over his dealings with a certain Adam Werrity, sitting in on lots of meetings and holding hands with him around the world. Liam Fox wants to cut taxes and benefits, he told us last week. So what did he really say?
Let me give you some examples of how I think we might remove benefits, but then also offer tax cuts that encourage the sort of behaviour that will make our economy more sustainable. Firstly, we could scrap the taxation of income gained through cash savings in the bank. This represents barely £2.7 billion or 0.5% of tax revenues. Secondly, we could look at limiting access to housing benefit for the under 25s. Total abolition could save £1.8 billion a year by 2015-16. We could make it the exception that people under 25 qualify for housing benefit rather than the rule. And I would balance such a move against a stamp duty discount for home buyers under 30, so that the incredible cost of buying a house is reduced for those in the earlier part of their career.
Home buyers under 30. There aren't all that many of those around, Martin, are there? Anyway, North Somerset Conservative MP Liam Fox there. What are your thoughts on the proposals?
Well, I mean, the welfare system is in fact an automatic stabilisation system, so that when the economy starts to dip, as it probably is doing at the moment, for the third time, but benefits go up automatically because more people claiming unemployment benefit, housing benefit, whatever, and that in fact protects the economy from falling down a hole. So basically Liam Fox is an economic ignoramus, and
but you're an economic ignoramus, because where's this money going to come from?
No, the point is that you actually, in Iceland, for example, they sack the bankers, put them in jail, they refused to pay the private sector debts that their banks had contracted, and they increased unemployment benefit. Because only 300,000 people in Iceland, if we're going to have 20% unemployment or whatever it was, we're going to make sure our people are looked after. Unemployment benefit should be increased. I mean, do you see what Beppe Grillo's talking about in Italy? Nationalisation of the banks and a citizens' income of €1,000 a month for that's a universal credit. Yeah, in other words, you get that €1,000 a month, and you don't have to, you don't have to look for work or whatever. That's
now,
what you'll get.
Lib Dem Councillor Mark Wright, I see you nodding there. This universal credit. You behind this Conservative policy then?
Universal credit is a conservative policy. just briefly on Liam Fox. I mean, the guy's nuts. Basically, what he wants to do is he wants tax breaks for his business chums, paid for by the poor. It's nothing new from him, actually. I mean, he's always been a crazy right winger. The idea of citizens' income actually is a very old idea and is a very interesting idea, and I think there's a lot of merit in it. It could, if done well, it could replace the whole benefit system in its entirety, and it could potentially be a lot cheaper to administer and to understand. It's something that is well worth investigating.
But I'm going to ask you the same as I asked Martin. Where's the money going to come from for such a thing? So you're saying free money for everybody who's on benefits?
Yeah. Everybody.
Yeah, for everybody who's everybody. That's the idea of a citizen's income.
But where's the money going to come from for that, Mark? I mean, you've got to be realistic.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it would obviously come from a readjustment of the economy and the tax system. You've got to bear in mind that not only does the welfare system at the moment costs around about £200 billion, quarter to a third of all government spending is already spent on that, but also a huge amount of that is actually just wasted in insofar as it's just about bureaucracy and testing and, deciding how much each person needs and all that kind of thing. There are huge savings to be made by simplifying the system, and that is, to be fair, that's part of what Ian Duncan Smith is trying to do with his idea of universal credit, which may or may not succeed because this is such a big and complex and difficult thing to do. But that doesn't mean that these ideas are not worth thinking about. I think, citizens' income, it would require a change in the mindset of the populace as well as to what does it mean to be a citizen. You know, that you, as a citizen, you would have to have, I think, certain responsibilities that would come along with the fact that you might, for example,
have to vote.
Yeah, exactly.
Or if you don't turn up to vote, you don't get your citizens' income.
Yeah, exactly.
That's another thing. Well, I mean, until this universal credit does arrive, or citizen income, or whatever it is, you've got a lot of the most vulnerable people suffering hard at the moment, and we're going to have protests here in Bristol and all over the country, in Bath and Bristol. It starts at noon on College Green, and in Bath it's at 1 p.m. at the Guildhall in the High Street in Bath about the bedroom tax. So let's go back to last week's Prime Minister's questions to hear a question about that.
Let me ask him about the cases of the hundreds of thousands of disabled people who'll be losing an average of £700 a year because of his bedroom tax. Is he going to fight for them like he's fighting for John the Banker?
Well, first of all, let us just remember what happened in 2008 when he was sitting in government. The biggest banking bust in our history. The build-up of the biggest deficit in our history. All the mess that we're having to deal with now was delivered by him and his henchmen in 2008. And what about one... I tell you what, before we go on to the spare room subsidy, let him get to his feet and apologise for the mess he left in this country. Apologise.
Well, I'm afraid it descends into more and more shouting and screaming at that point for half a minute or so. Mark, what's your thoughts about this bedroom tax? Is it really going to be a kind of watershed moment for the government? Feels to me a little bit like the poll tax. It's like there's enough people around the country are just feeling that they've gone too far somehow.
I suspect it won't be like the poll tax, and the reason for that is because although a lot of people are very upset about it, it's going to affect a relatively low number of people. I mean, the poll tax applied to literally everyone in the country.
But those people are the sorts of people that everybody knows somebody.
Yes, I mean,
most people
yes.
know somebody that's affected by this. And most people really understand the basic fact that there aren't enough single bedroom places to go around for people. I mean, you're trying to move people. The other thing is that the various surveys that have been done have actually said that this is highly likely to increase the benefits bill because it's moving people from social housing out into private housing. Because of the increased demand on private housing, that's going to push up rents and push up the benefit bill.
Yeah, I think, if we look at where this idea is coming from, this is about dealing with the fact that there are quite a lot of social homes and council homes which housing benefits being paid for and which not all of the bedrooms are being used. So this is what they call under occupancy. This has been an issue for a number of years, at least a decade. And people have been thinking about how we might solve this problem, how we might encourage people to use more of the bedrooms or to move into flats which have got less bedrooms. Now, the idea that they've come up with, I think, is flawed. And the key reason it's flawed is, as you pointed out, people may well say, OK, yeah, fair point. So I'm under-occupying this flat. I want to move in order to do this. As you've pointed out, there are not enough of the lower bedroomed properties for them to move into because we're so short of properties. So then what they're going to do? We have these people who are saying, yeah, I want to move. I want to move. What are you going to do about it? And the council's not going to be able to do anything about it because it doesn't have the properties to move them into. And I think this is what the government somehow have not quite worked out.
So what's the scenario? If someone is being forced to, they simply can't pay their rent, are they just simply going to be evicted onto the street rather than into a one-bedroom flat because there aren't enough one-bedroom flats around?
I suspect... I don't know. First of all, I mean, it's very difficult for the council to evict residents even when they're behind, even when they're behind on rent. In the first instance, what will happen is that their rent arrears will effectively become debts that the council holds. So, I mean, the leader of the Lib Dem group on the council wrote to the Secretary of State pointing out that what we're really looking at in the short term is a government saving, which is going to translate simply into a council debt. So they're simply moving one debt from one balance sheet to another balance sheet.
So people who are in social housing don't necessarily need to be too worried that they're going to be thrown out on the streets.
Well, I mean, they do need to be worried, but whether the social landlords and council either have the ability or the money to start mass evictions, I doubt. I mean, what this is, I suspect, most likely to result in is just lots of debts at a local level instead of at a national level.
Martin, bedroom tax.
Well, I mean, it's a slow-motion train wreck, isn't it, really? I mean, the people have pointed out that, in actual fact, it's probably not going to save any money, because once you put people into the private sector, and, of course, it's the housing associations, not just the councils, they will lose... They're trying to budget, and they're going to have to budget for people who are not going to be paying their rent. and it's going to, you know, debt advice centres are going to be inundated. It's, I mean, you know, the situation is bad enough as it is. The economy's dead in the water. The economic policy of the government's shot to pieces. But they insist on going for these ideological own goals, really.
So what would you do?
Well, what we really need to do is what Vince Cable is suggesting. We need to build social housing. We should have been doing it 30, 40 years ago.
But we can't.
That's
go
what
back
we
30,
used to do.
We can't go back 30, 40 years.
No, but we could start now doing the right thing, couldn't we? We could reboot the economy by building some houses for people on low incomes. It's a no-brainer, but we're not going to do it, are we? We're not going to do it.
There's thousands and thousands of house and homes and with planning permission right now, which are currently mothballed because the developers are unable to get finance because the banks are hoarding all of the quantitative easing cash that the government's creating and shoveling at them. You know, I mean, we need to force the banks in order to cough up this money, and then
so
we can unlock.
You're going to get into Barclays with your crowbar.
But the retail bankers are quite right to say we're not going to lend money into an economy with no demand. And it's you know, the banks, they're also being told to improve their bottom line so that they can be privatised, apparently. But, of course, they're all bankrupt. They've been bankrupt all along. And what should have been happening is the system should have been dismantled. As Beppe Grillo says, nationalise the banks, give us
a
citizen's income,
as Mark points out,
we go.
There's been all this quantitative easing, propping the banks up. The idea is that there have been several programmes now to force the banks, to encourage the banks to lend, but they're not actually doing it.
Yes, because it's like pushing on a string. The banks quite rightly say, I'm not going to lend you money, Tony, to set up your business because it will fail. And looking at the figures, given the demand in the economy, no, we're not going to lend you the money. The bankers are right to not lend the money unless there's demand in the economy. But of course, propping the banks up is all that's happened. We've kept the banks. What that means really is the assets of the wealthy have been protected by the taxpayer. Meanwhile, poor people at the bottom of the pile are going to have to take their kids out of school, move places they don't where they can't get to work. It's class war from the top. But this country's got a fantastic tradition of class war from the bottom. And soon we're going to get the ball, and then we will see.
Extract from Prime Minister's questions this week, this time, when Ian Murray asked the Prime Minister whether he will personally benefit. As this question crops up quite regularly at Prime Minister's questions nowadays. Will he personally benefit from the millionaires' tax cuts?
Mr. Ian Murray.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Will the Prime Minister benefit personally from the millionaire's tax cut?
Let me say to the honourable gentleman, I will pay all of the taxes that I'm meant to. But let me just point out one small point. I had a letter this week. I thought people might enjoy. It's from Ed, who lives in Camden, and it says this: I am a millionaire. I live in a house worth £2 million, which I got through a combination of inheritance and property speculation. I'm worried that if I sell my house and I buy another one, I'll have to pay the 7% stamp duty that the wicked Tories have introduced. Under Labour, well, we talked about fairness, we never made the rich pay more. What should a champagne socialist like me do?
Follows more raucous noises. Anyway, Mark, right, the point really being there that David Cameron didn't want to answer the question, and he came up with a sort of pre-prepared statement about taking the mickey out of the leader of the opposition for also having quite a lot of money. Now, ultimately, it starts to look as if, you know, there's a kind of bully prime minister who is simply using his position to feather his own nest.
From that answer, it does. I mean, I think that was a ridiculous answer, and it was very, it wasn't poor. But not only that, he could have actually said that at the same time as the 50p tax was cut to 45p, capital gains tax was ramped up, stamp duty was ramped up, and a number of other taxes which affect essentially the most wealthy were ramped up. And the IFS came back with some figures saying...
That's the Institute for Fiscal Studies.
Yes, of course it is. Came back saying that due to the changes of that particular budget, the most wealthy would be paying four times more in extra taxes than they were making from the cut in the 45 pence of the 50p rate to the 45p rate. So I think actually, I think that budget was was quite good. I mean, if you would read, say, the Telegraph newspaper after that budget came out, it was absolutely howling, in particular about the capital gains tax rate, because the real money in this world is not made through incomes. The real money in this world is made through capital gains, in particular property. Most of the world's equity is in the form of property, and that's where the government should really be looking.
Martin, that sounds great, doesn't it? I mean, you're always moaning about people putting their money into property speculative bubbles and this kind of thing, and they've actually made an effort there to do something about it.
Well, yes, I mean, we need to have land value taxation.
Yes,
I mean,
yes.
The Labour Party is sort of walking backwards towards these kind of ideas. Mm. And I think that the moment for new ideas has come.
Yes.
We saw in Italy with the Beppe Grillo putting forward on the table a citizen's income.
Mm.
We haven't seen that before, but this is the only positive thing about this crisis. If we grasp it properly, we can actually start to say, well, what do we want? Because we're actually in a position now to... And ultimately, I would see sensible Liberal Democrats basically getting out of the abusive relationship that they are in with the Tories. You know, they go home every night for a black eye, and eventually you're going to get fed up with it.
Well, that's what you want, Martin. Maybe we'll ask Mark in a minute what he wants. What I want is Chris Skidmore, the MP, to come on this programme, because he's one of the three city slacker MPs who have constantly been phoning and have either just not returned phone calls or simply point-blank refused to come on the radio to discuss politics. I mean, obviously, we're only a little community radio station, and they may decide they've got better things to do. But I'm desperate to get Chris. Anyone knows Chris Skidmore, the MP for Kingswood, please ask him to come down just to do a news review one week here on a Friday. He's usually in his constituency, so it shouldn't be too much effort. But here he is. I actually got him this week because he was on Prime Minister's Questions. He asked a question about the National Health Service. So here he is. Let's see how he got on.
Chris Skidmore.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. In 1997, there were no excess deaths in the mortality data at Mid Staffordshire Hospital. But as early as 2002, there were 120 excess deaths. That figure only rose year upon year, and yet Labour Health Secretary after Labour Health Secretary did nothing apart from to award the Trust Foundation status in 2009. In total, 1,197 excess deaths occurred. Some of those were patients who died in their own faeces. Does the Prime Minister not believe that the Mid Staffordshire scandal underlines the fact that Labour's supposed claim to be the party of the NHS is the greatest lie in British politics?
Order! Chair, but first of all, I'm afraid the question was too long, and secondly, I would ask the Prime Minister to bear in mind what is his responsibility and what isn't, with a very brief answer, and then we can move on. Prime Minister.
Well, my responsibility is to respond properly to the Francis report, and I commend Francis for what he did, but it is important to remember that it is this government that set up a proper independent inquiry into the disgraces that happened at Midstaffs. Everyone has to learn their lessons, including ministers in the government opposite, from what went wrong, but I think we should listen to Francis when he says we should not seek scapegoats. But what we do need to do, right across politics, right across this house, right across our country, is end any culture of complacency. I love our NHS. There are some fantastic parts to our NHS, but in too many parts, we do see, as he said, very bad figures, and we need to deal with them.
Yeah, that was Chris Skidmore, that's the Tory MP for Kingswood, at this week's Prime Minister's Questions.
Well, yes, I mean, obviously, where things go wrong in the health service, we need transparency and we need to know what's going on. But you had a clip the other week where somebody made the obvious point, which is managers, if they don't meet their financial targets, they get sacked. But if people die on the ward because they have, for example, understaffed wards, that's just collateral damage, and that's the wrong way to run a health service.
But you did dodge the question there to a certain extent, because what Chris is saying is actually the reason we've got all these problems right now in the health service is because of the original decisions made by your party about 5-6 years ago.
The Labour Party accepted the whole idea of the producer-purchaser split. And the whole marketisation of the health service, which was absolutely stupid in my view. The case for having a top-down plan has to be made. I'm not a liberal economist, I'm a socialist. I believe in having a top-down plan. You know why? Because it's the cheapest and most effective way to do things. And all this kind of pseudo-marketing market, which the new Labour and the current coalition are pushing on the health service, is simply wrong. Just wrong. It's the wrong way to do it. The British National Health Service isn't the best in the world, but it's by far the cheapest. And that's the fact, and that is because it is a centrally planned system, even now.
Okay, Mark Wright, Lib Dem councillor. We also had news this week, which kind of makes it sound even more awful. Yet another affront from the National Health Service chief. That's an editorial in the Daily Mail on 13th of March. Only 6 days after telling MPs it's utterly unacceptable and illegal to impose gagging orders on NHS whistleblowers, the man with no shame accepts the appointment of his deputy as his deputy of a woman accused of doing just that. Indeed, Sir David Nicholson is determined to rub the public's noses in his invincibility and contempt for his critics. This is the man now promoted to NHS chief executive who presided over the hospitals where 1,200 patients died of inhuman neglect, many being left lying in excrement for days, whilst others had to drink dirty water from flower vases. His new deputy, Dame Barbara Haken, stands accused of helping to authorise £500,000, £500,000, to silence one hospital chief executive who was sacked after warning that targets were threatening lives. It doesn't give you confidence in the leadership of the health service, Mark.
No, it doesn't, and I would frankly be amazed if this guy's still in his job at the end of this year.
And you can't blame this on the previous Labour government either. They can't blame this on the previous Labour government. They've had 2 years to sort out the management of the health service.
No, indeed. I suspect that what will happen is that more and more dirt will be dug up and it will all be thrown on this guy, and then this guy will carry the can and he'll disappear and he'll be replaced by someone else. I suspect that the government probably wants him to hang around for long enough to pick up most of the dirt, otherwise we'll get someone new in and then they'll end up getting tarnished with some more of the dirt that's dug up as well. There are clearly problems. I think just to come back on what was said just a minute ago, I'm not convinced actually myself that the Staffordshire problems relate to the fact of New Labour's reforms. I think that they could have happened under any system, and really the problem that there is there is a culture of hushing things up and a culture of secrecy inside the NHS. And the NHS is a great institution, it is one of the best health services in the world, but at the same time trying to criticise and investigate the NHS is almost like a no-go area and has been for quite a long time. And I think that's an unhealthy situation. And I think actually, you would say this because I'm a politician, but arguably if the press would probably spend a little bit more time investigating some of the other great institutions of the state rather than just politicians, there might be some things that they could uncover, some things which really need to be uncovered, and it would be better if that happened sooner rather than later. But I would like that to be done by the press that is a critical friend of the NHS. The problem with doing this via the Daily Mail and the Daily Telegraph is that they want to destroy the NHS ultimately. Then they're gleeful when they find these kind of problems because it gives them ammunition. I mean, what we really need is for press which is supportive of the NHS to also uncover these things so that it can be reported in a sensible way.
Well, coming a little bit closer to home, Bristol City Council spent more than £23,000 of our taxpayers' money on an attempt to ban the press from reporting details of a controversial fostering case. That's in the Post this week. The Post reported in January that an adoption case heard at Bristol's Family Proceedings Court revealed how it took 2 weeks for social services to remove a 4-year-old girl from a foster family, despite the foster father being under suspicion of possessing indecent images of children. Without warning the media on the final day of the case, the council went to the civil court to get an injunction banning any reporting of the case. Well, no, I mean, Mark, these family courts are notoriously secretive anyway. Why is the council spending, what for many people might be double their annual salary on trying to stop the press reporting a case which is actually under reporting restrictions already?
Yeah. I mean, this is
that's our money.
It is. And we do have a right to ask and get an answer of why that money was spent and what the council was aiming to do. I mean, the council's response is that they went to get a secrecy order on this because there was at that time there was no restriction on publishing the name of the child or the children's family, and I think it's actually not unreasonable of the council actually to have acted in that regard, because the press might not have reported the name of the family and the child, but they were at liberty to, and they might have done, and that was a risk. I think it would have been wrong for the child to have been named, and that was a risk that the council didn't want to take. Now, you could also say that, rather conveniently, the fact that then got gagged meant that you know, none of the rest of the case was exposed either. And that is, you know, that's a fair point. And that's, I'm not particularly happy about that. I mean, I suspect that the council, you might suggest that the council wouldn't want people to know that it took 2 weeks to remove someone from someone who was under suspicion.
That's certainly what it looks like, isn't
yes,
it? It's just to save the council's face. Martin?
Yeah, well, that's the first time I've heard about this is on the show. I mean, I presume there is a rationale, you know, protecting the child's identity and so on. But on the other hand, you know, we need transparency, but we need to protect people's, you know, especially vulnerable people like children.
Yeah, but I mean, this is a blanket injunction on this case that they've called for here. So, I mean, it's not just about that child's identity, is what I'm trying to say here. Mm. And also, this is a lot of money, you know. And actually, Evening Post have done a great job, I think, with their freedom of information request in getting this out to the public. There's no reason why we shouldn't know the details of the case. We don't necessarily need to know the names. And also, you know, what's your thoughts on the way the family courts operate generally, because they're, you know, quite often cases are heard without even important people involved in that case being allowed to know it's taking place. They're very secretive.
Well, I'm just flabbergasted because you've just said something positive about the Bristol Evening Post. I think I'm having a senior moment. Well, yes, I mean, I'm not really an expert on family courts, I have to say. So, I could come up with some kind of trite remark about it, but I don't think I will. I don't know enough about it to have a strong opinion.
Yes, we've got a new head of legal services, I believe, at the City Council. It was up until recently Stephen McNamara.
Yes, it was.
Who was the returning officer for the elections. And this is really, it's Mr. Nevin. I'm not sure what do you know what his first name is?
No, I can't remember it. I did know.
Maybe it's Stephen. I don't know. I can't remember. But anyway, we've got a new head of legal services. This is one of those jobs at the City Council, which is not necessarily very well known about. I remember McNamara wasn't even on the Bristol City Council website anyway, even though he was the most powerful lawyer in the city. Maybe he's, you know, he was trying to gag himself somehow. Goodness knows what he was up to there. But this is a very important role, isn't it? And what kind of political control is the head of legal services under, Mark?
It is an important role, and it's to be honest, I wouldn't wish it on anyone. It's a real thankless job, because of course the solicitor ends up in the middle of all of the party battles as well, and often has to adjudicate on legal disputes in terms of council motions and policy between the various political parties.
Sorry, it's Liam Nevin.
Liam, he's our new
head of legal.
Yes, it is Liam, and many councillors have run-ins with the senior legal officer, and I've already sent him some strongly worded letters and disagreeing with his judgments on various things. And you know, it has been said that if the chief legal officer isn't annoying all of the political parties, he's not doing his job properly. He is new in the job. I suspect he's probably being a bit more cautious at the moment than he needs to be, because it is the tendency of people who are new in job to be cautious rather than bold. I don't think that's necessarily a problem. I think that he will. I think and hope that he will grow into the job. I know a lot of people had harsh words to say about Stephen McNamara. I thought actually he was a reasonable enough bloke. He did, you know, he had a tightrope to walk, and he walked that tightrope for a number of years. I once famously called him a rapscallion, which he said was the first he'd been called many things in his life, and that was the first time he'd ever been called a rapscallion. But the chief legal officer comes in for a lot of stick from all sorts of directions, and answers directly to the chief executive.
Okay.
They're very independent politically. They're not under political control.
Is the chief executive under political control?
No.
Only by appointment. So the politicians we elect appoint the chief executive, but
that's right.
Once they're appointed, they're free to do it. Have we actually got a chief executive at the moment?
Because
I know for a while we kind of decided we're going to get rid of the chief executive. So what happens in that situation with maybe he's completely, he can do what he wants?
We've had, since Jan Ormondroyd, who was a very good chief executive, I think, she stepped down last year. We had an interim chief executive who was Graham Sims, who also was a very good man in place. He's just retired. So we've got a second acting chief executive who is new to the council. It's a lady whose name escapes me at the moment because she is new and I don't know her particularly well. I think I assume that she will be pretty reasonable. I'm glad that we are keeping a chief executive. I know that it was in vogue last year for a number of political parties and people to say that they didn't think we needed a chief executive. Personally, I think it's absolutely bonkers to try and and run a council without a chief executive, to try for the politicians to assume that they can be executive directors and directors of the departments at the same time is very self-indulgent, because the reality is managing an organisation like the council is a skill set that politicians don't have.
Councillors for hire who gives firms planning advice. This is an investigation by the Daily Telegraph. Councillors across England are offering themselves for hire to property developers who are hoping to take advantage of relaxed planning laws which come into effect within weeks. One Tory councillor in East Devon, Graham Brown, boasted, "If I can't get you planning, nobody will." He preferred to keep a low profile, he said to the Telegraph's undercover reporters, but had access to all the right people for all the right clients. He added, "I don't come cheap. I mean, there are jobs that I do for a grand, and there are jobs that I do for 20 grand. If I turn a greenfield into a housing estate, I'm earning the developer 2 or 3 million. I ain't doing it for peanuts." And that's a Conservative councillor in East Devon, Graham Brown. In Newcastle, Greg Stone, a Liberal Democrat councillor who works for the firm called Indigo Public Affairs, the same firm, boasted the company had a good chance that via our network, someone will know someone who knows someone at every council. The tricks of the trade used to gain planning approval include making sure planning committees included friendly faces. Now, as a former chair of one of the planning committees in the city here, Mark, what do you make of this?
It doesn't look good. It doesn't look good. And, you know, I mean, the public will look at this and they'll think politicians on the make.
They will think that the developers are just going to make a call to Indigo Public Affairs, who are employing these people, and in order to get their planning permission rather than go through the proper processes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, of course, the developers still have to go through the proper processes, but I think the point of this consultancy that they're getting is that they find out, you know, how they find the best path through the proper processes that can get their permissions accepted. I mean, I was aware that there were consultancies for these things going on. I have to say the sums mentioned here are a bit surprising and a bit shocking to me. I was under the impression that we were talking about hundreds of pounds.
Didn't you get figures like this when you were on the planning committee?
No, not at all. I can assure you I've never made even 50 pence from these things, which is a reality. I think for the vast, it's worth pointing out, the vast majority of councillors,
so
there's no real way to make any money
that are doing this, because this really isn't on, is it? Particularly for people who are having to live with the development, they don't want councillors having, you know, well, effectively are not declared at the meetings secret relationships with the developers when they're voting on a planning application.
I think that if you delve into this stuff, you find that it would definitely be considered a prejudicial interest for a councillor to be on the committee and then to still have advised one of these organisations. I think in the stuff that I read, they were fairly clear in saying that they would not be sitting on the planning committees themselves when they were on these consultancies, because that would be a clear conflict of interest, and I think it's probably illegal for them to do that.
Yes, a sort of at arm's length, maybe.
Yeah, that's right.
Another councillor in the same party, or maybe even a different party.
Yeah, that's the kind
so
of thing.
So maybe some of the money might pass on to the other councillor,
yeah.
You know.
I mean, some of these jobs may be declared in the councillor's register of interests, and you can go to the Bristol City Council's and any council's website and look at all the things that are declared. You know, councillors will declare their jobs and their various other bits and pieces. Again, one thing I would point out is that this is also true of MPs. MPs sit on the boards of numerous companies with interests in Parliament and legislation that's passing through. You know, councillors have a lot less power than MPs, and no doubt can make a lot less money. Of course, one of the things which is sometimes in the news is which MPs are on the boards of, you know, which organisations that are lobbying government at this very moment in order to change laws and legislations. The government did have an idea to try to create very strict laws about lobbying and consultancies in terms of getting these things declared, and I'm very much a big supporter of that, and I certainly wouldn't oppose the same thing in terms of councillors as well, although I do think that in general you would be surprised at how little of interest that councillors do outside of their outside of their political roles.
Martin, what are your thoughts about this Telegraph expose here?
Well, I mean, in Norway, everybody's tax returns are public property. So whether you're the Prime Minister, who was Flim Flamming earlier, refusing to answer questions about what he was worth and whether he benefited from tax changes, or a councillor, or anybody, a business person, everybody's tax returns are online in Norway and everybody can see who's got what.
But I mean, these amounts being paid here, you know, the sort of thousands of pounds, are peanuts compared to the amount of money that a developer makes on a piece of land when they get suddenly, well, you know, say for example, like one of these big stadiums, they buy the land as a bit of greenfield land, as a farmer's field, and they get to put a stadium on it. They're making millions.
Yes, and you've got the chap who runs Avonmouth Port phoning up saying he doesn't want a barrage because he's given the Tory party loads of money. Money and politics needs to be sorted out. In Scandinavia, all political parties are funded by the state, according to their level of support. It makes a difference. And, of course, in Norway as well, everybody's tax returns are online.
Okay.
People can see what people are worth. Think, hang on, I mean, they could pay a bit more
tax.
Okay,
our final story, and I don't know if it's political, but we've got a new pope, we've got a new archbishop, both at the same time. Mm. Quite an interesting combination. Wobbly Welby, says the Daily Mail. The archbishop and the oil sharks, the slick young Justin Welby, the shady Monsieur Africa, and £6 billion mission to snap Nigeria. Nigeria's oil riches with catastrophic results. Actually, a very interesting article about the Archbishop of Canterbury, new Archbishop of Canterbury's past, working for Elf Oil Company for 5 years, alongside a guy, Andre Torello, who was later jailed as part of a $6 billion deal to deter Nigeria from nationalising its oil industry, which was quite successful because that never happened. Is this the right guy to be the Archbishop of Canterbury? He's a city fund chief, and he's also an ex-fixer for Elf Oil in Nigeria.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, when he became Archbishop at first, one of the things that was said to be in his favour was the fact that he had had a life outside of religion. You know, he had been a successful businessman, and a lot of people thought that maybe this would be a positive thing in terms of bringing, you know, the church back in touch with the realities. A particular contrast with the previous Archbishop of Canterbury, who was effectively an academic. You know, I mean, he was a real theologist. He had spent most of his time literally sitting in a room thinking about theological problems.
But this guy's described as a finance shark. I mean, do you want a shark running the Church of England?
I mean, I would say that, to be honest, that's up to the Church of England. I mean, I'm not religious. I mean, likewise with, you know, the new guy that's made it through to be Pope. I mean, he's got a very interesting past to do. There's all sorts of questions about the role he had in during the so-called dirty war in Argentina, when the military dictatorship was running the place. You know, as was often the case when these fascist regimes were running countries both in Europe and in South America, the Church was strangely quiet through a lot of these periods.
Martin, what about you on the Archbishop Welby particularly?
Well, I mean, he did come out and say the bedroom tax and various other things. You know, he criticised the government's welfare policy, which is pretty much what Rowan Williams would have done.
But is it, you know, is it a good idea to have a city bigwig and an ex-oil chief guy in charge? He seems, the other thing is about it, he seems to have parachuted in out of nowhere.
Well, he's an ex-Etonian as well, isn't he?
He'll feel at home
in that school for scoundrels.
Okay, what about the Pope then? Mark's just mentioned him.
Well, yes, I've never heard of him before.
The first one from South America.
Yes, I've never heard of him before, but I mean, there are questions about his role during the Dirty War, and, you know, no doubt.
What are those questions, and what was the Dirty War?
Basically, the Dirty War, 30,000 people were disappeared in Argentina, and, you know, we're remembering the Falklands War and the British soldiers that died, and you know, that was all pretty badly terrible for the families concerned. But, of course, being killed in Argentina wasn't being shot in a battle. It meant being tortured to death over 48 hours, raped by Alsatian dogs, electrocuted. A bit braver than fighting in a battle, eh?
Okay, well, it's coming up now. Time for the Murdoch News at 6 o'clock. Thanks to this week's guest, Lib Dem Councillor for Cabot Ward in the city centre, Mark Wright. Thank you, Mark. After the news, the voice of a true US Army hero. Leaked audio recording of Bradley Manning giving his secret testimony to a secret court about why he gave cables, and footage of Reuters cameramen being killed by a US helicopter to WikiLeaks.
.org.uk. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the sky.